I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. They are the third of the population who prefer to listen instead of speak, read instead of party, work alone instead of in a group. They're the quiet ones, and now they have a new spokesperson, author Susan Cain. We live in a culture that she says is geared toward the more outgoing, but today she talks to us about the value of introverts in a loud and proud society. We'll listen in as she talks with us about famed leaders, Einstein, Van Gogh, Gandhi, Rosa Parks, who relied on reserved temperaments to guide them to success. It's a conversation on the power of introverts in a world that can't stop talking. Plus, the harmonious music of four men in bow ties and boaters. Yep, a barbershop quartet is here. It's Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Warren Buffett is an introvert. So was Eleanor Roosevelt and Gandhi, George Orwell and Rosa Parks. These days, an estimated half of all Americans are introverts, and yet our guest today says there's a bias against them. Our schools, workplaces, and churches are designed for extroverts. The bias is so profound that many introverts think there's something wrong with them and that they should try to somehow get by in life as extroverts. Later on this hour, the joy of barbershop quartets. But first up, author Susan Cain joins us to talk about her new book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, which has been living on the New York Times bestseller list. She taught corporate law for 7 years, and this is a book I spotted on the top shelf at Rainy Day Books and thought, this is a book worth talking about. Susan Cain joins us this morning from her home in New York. Susan, nice to have you. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. It's so nice to be here with you.
Well, interesting idea. You say there's a bias in our culture against introverts. How so?
Well, you know, if you think about who the ideal self is in our culture, it really is somebody who is bold and entertaining and really at home in the spotlight. And, you know, you can see this if you look at the way our schools and our workplaces are set up. From a very early age, children are introduced into a preschool setting where they're expected to behave in group situations.
Mm-hmm.
And our schools are increasingly being taught in groups so that children are focused on classroom exercises like math and like creative writing. And, you know, these are exercises that you would think would depend on kind of solo flights of thought, but instead children are working in groups. And the same thing is happening now in our workplaces where everything is set up now in open plan offices in the majority of our workplaces, you know, where you're sitting in offices without walls and with very little respite from the noise or the gaze of coworkers.
So there isn't room to think. There isn't room to be an introvert in our world very much anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, what introversion really is at the end of the day is it's about a preference for environments that are less stimulating. Hmm. And by stimulating, I don't mean less interesting. I just mean you know, kind of less stimulation coming at you, which is an important thing to say because people often think that introversion is about being antisocial in some way or asocial. And it's really not that at all. It's just a preference for kind of socializing in these quieter ways. And yet when our major institutions, our schools, our workplaces, and so on, are set up for maximum stimulation, introverts are having to spend a lot of energy just to overcome these environments that don't suit them, instead of focusing on their projects.
You know, along the same line, Susan, at the TED conference, you told just a terrific story about going to summer camp as a girl and taking along a bag of books, which it turned out you never got to read that summer. What was the message you got from your own summer camp?
Well, yeah, you know, I told a story about how, you know, to me, going to camp was going to be this great experience where I would sit around with a group of friends and we would all be reading together, kind of the way I did with my family back home. And it really wasn't like that at all. Camp was instead this experience where you're expected to, you know, to participate in very rowdy, boisterous activities in the morning through night. And, you know, that was one of many, many, many experiences I had as a child where I kind of got this subtle message that my preferences for how to spend my time were not in sync with what was expected of me and of other kids. And, you know, and it's kind of a subtle thing, but it's a potent thing, too, because you get the message unmistakably that the person that you are is not quite the ideal person, and that you have to make subtle shifts in order to be accepted.
Yeah, ultimately,
and you know, and over time, those shifts get less subtle. You know, it can really translate into making career choices that are wrong or making life choices that are wrong because you're trying to be more of an extrovert than you truly are.
Well, you translate this to the idea that introverts tend to be undervalued, and that's because they're quiet, right? And they're easily overlooked.
Yeah, you know, because they're quiet, or, you know, even if they're not always quiet, what ends up happening is, in a situation like a meeting, for example, introverts will often feel, you know, introverts by definition almost, they like to think before they speak. And because of what I was talking about before, where they feel overstimulated more easily,
yeah.
In a situation like a meeting, you know, they'll often think of the thing that they want to say, but by that time the meeting is over. And so, you know, even if they're not always quiet, they're quiet at that moment that is seen as the crucial moment. So what I talk about in the book is the need to try to get the best of people's brains in different ways from what we have been doing thus far. You know, like normally in a corporation, let's say, you want to get the best of people's brains about solving a problem or coming up with a creative solution to something. So you throw everyone into a meeting and see what happens. But in fact, that's a terrible way to do things, because we know from studies that the person who gets listened to in a setting like that is usually the person who's the best talker or the most charismatic person in the room. And that person might have the best ideas, but they really might not.
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to think more deeply about how can we make sure everybody is contributing at their best.
Yeah, and you point out that people tend to be more creative, Susan, when they enjoy privacy and freedom from interruption. And the most spectacularly creative people in many fields are often introverted. Why is that, do you think? Why is there a connection between being creative and enjoying privacy?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. It turns out that if you look at studies of brainstorming, people have been looking at this for over 40 years now. If you look at studies of brainstorming, you find that individuals who are brainstorming kind of on their own almost always produce more ideas and better ideas than groups of people who are brainstorming together.
Mm.
And the reason for this seems to be, well, there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is that people really are kind of freaked out by peer pressure at the end of the day. You know, introverts tend to be freaked out by it, but it's extroverts as well. And when you are with other people, you can't focus quite in the same way because there's a part of your brain that is always thinking about how other people are judging the ideas that you're advancing. And in fact, the neuroscientist Gregory Burns recently found that when you take a stance that's different from that of the group, the amygdala, which is a part of your brain that gets activated when you're feeling social rejection, your amygdala starts getting really active.
Hmm.
And he calls this the pain of independence. You know, so what it means is if you're sitting in a group and you're trying to brainstorm an idea and you're thinking in a way that is different from the group, which is what you want to be doing if you're being creative, that, by definition, is going to get the part of your brain that is sensitive to social rejection all fired up. So that's just one of the many problems that happen when you get into a group, and why it is that for centuries people have gone off by themselves when they want to think profound thoughts. And I'm not saying they shouldn't then come back to the group, because they should. You know, of course, you need to exchange ideas also as part of the creative process. But what gets lost nowadays is the importance of solitude in that.
Well, you just sort of wonder if you flip the coin around a little bit, if you're an individual and you decide to work for a large organization, do even introverts, Susan, bear some responsibility, you know, to get noticed, to take part in conversations, even when it's not comfortable or their natural inclination to do so?
Yep, absolutely. And I'm glad you asked that question. I do believe that they do. I think that we all need to step outside of our natural temperaments. And extroverts need to do this too, you know, some of the time. For example, if they are sitting and working on a memo when they might prefer to be chatting with their colleagues, you know, that's an exercise for an extrovert in being more introverted than they might prefer. So we all need to do that some of the time. The issue is that we shouldn't be having to do it all of the time, and that it's in all of our interests to kind of meet each other halfway. And and set up workplaces that cater to both types of people. And that it's in all of our interests to do this.
We're visiting with Susan Cain, author of a new bestseller, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Are you an introvert? If you'd like to call us and share your experiences in a world that Susan Cain describes as one that can't stop talking, give us a call at 816-235-2888. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. You know, Susan, it wasn't always the case in our culture, and you point this out in the book, where we devalued introverts. In fact, once upon a time, they were recognized and even prized. Why did we change?
Yeah, this is a fascinating piece of history that I traced in the book. What happened is we used to live in a more agricultural economy, right? And in that situation, we were spending most of our lives, including our work lives, working alongside people who had known us from the time that we were kids. And so we valued each other back then more on the content of our characters. And historians call this the culture of character. You know, and what mattered was what kinds of good deeds do you perform, especially when nobody is actually looking. You know, what kind of person are you really? But then all of a sudden, we entered this world of big business, and people started leaving their small towns, going into the cities, and now suddenly they're facing the question of how do I stand out in a crowd full of people who have no idea who I am?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm showing up at this job interview; they don't know me. How can I make myself likable? So suddenly, qualities like being very magnetic, being very charismatic, being the dominant person who can take charge of a room, these were the things that suddenly became very important. You know, and at the same time, this was when we saw the rise of movies. I mean, really, the introduction of movies and the rise of movie stars. So, like, all week long, you're facing the question of how do I stand out at work? And then you go to the movies on the weekend and you see these movie stars who are the very embodiment of how to be a charismatic person.
Mm.
So it was kind of a perfect storm of cultural forces that led to what historians call a culture of personality. It started at the turn of the 20th century.
Mm.
Now here we are 100 years later, and we're still really living with that culture today in ways that I think we need to examine.
That's an interesting change. We received this email from a listener. I am an off-the-wall introvert, this woman writes, married to an off-the-chart extrovert. I've read Quiet as well as The Introvert Advantage. I've struggled throughout my marriage and role as a mother to allow my introverted nature to thrive, let alone survive. It can be debilitating as a medical illness, certainly a sense of mental illness. Understanding introversion and embracing this its powerful place in society is terribly undervalued. So she's right down the pike with you on that, Susan.
Yeah. And, you know, it's poignant when she speaks of, the idea of being such a fish out of water to being something akin to a mental illness or a medical illness. I think that without explicitly saying so, that is often the way that we view introversion today. You know, it's kind of a pathology,
mm-hmm.
Which is such a problem, because what we're really talking about is a normal personality trait that, as you said at the beginning, is present in somewhere between a third to a half of the population. So that's a lot of people who are walking around feeling a kind of secret sense of shame about who they are.
Hmm.
And often these are people who are very high-functioning people, very successful people, and you wouldn't even know that they're introverts, but because I'm the person who wrote a book about it, people come and they tell me how they truly feel. And I can tell you that, like, the most unlikely people tell me their stories of who they truly are, as opposed to the person of, you know, who they present to the real world, to the outside world.
Yeah. And for the sake of full disclosure, we should point out that you describe yourself as an introvert, which may not be surprising given the fact you wrote the book, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and now I'm in this funny position, like, I'm here in a book tour, and so I'm talking about, I'm out in the public spotlight a lot of the time. and people sometimes say, what is that like as an introvert? And, you know, and it is a funny thing. I care so much about these ideas, and I'm so excited to talk about them, that helps me to do what I found in my book research many introverts do. Like, if they get really passionate about a cause, that helps them transcend their normal aversion to the spotlight.
Yeah, I was watching your TEDx talk for any signs of introversion, Susan, and didn't see any. You handled yourself pretty well, I thought.
Well, I mean, I guess the answer to that is thank you. But, you know, I would like to be really honest about that. because some of my readers have seen the TED Talk and have said to me that it made them feel kind of bad as an introvert, that they felt that they couldn't do what they saw me doing.
Mm.
So because people have told me that, I want to be really honest, actually, about what I went through to do that talk. I mean, I really, really prepared, and I really practiced, and I went through moments of great suffering, I would say, where, like, you know, I really had to confront my demons of fear about what it meant to get up into that kind of a spotlight with that many people looking at me.
Well, it's
so just to say, like, it wasn't like it came easy, and there are ways to push yourself to do these things when you feel like it's worth it.
Well, it was clear to me that you were well rehearsed because you weren't referring to notes, at least nothing that I could see. You just were riffing seemingly off the top of your head.
Yeah, no, that's true. But it was not off the top of my head.
Okay.
It was very much rehearsed. I actually worked with a coach in the week before.
Wow.
In the week before the talk. Yeah, I worked with an acting coach, which was incredibly helpful for me.
And what did the acting coach help you with? What did he or she do for you?
Well, you know, the first thing that happened, I thought was brilliant of him. His guy named Jim Fife. And on the first day, I said to him, you know, I'm comfortable with one-on-one conversations. What I'm not comfortable with is sort of performance. You know, mm-hmm. where you have to sort of take the stage and hold a spotlight. And so he said, okay, we're going to spend the whole first day of our practice not doing this as a performance at all. We're just going to sit on a sofa together, and you're going to tell me your TED Talk as if this was just a regular conversation. And so that's what we did for about 6 hours. We just sat on the couch, and I told him, and I ran through my talk that way. And that helped me get a sense of sort of emotional comfort with the words, where I was no longer associating them with something scary, like a stage, but instead it was just, you know, a comfortable sofa. Comfortable conversation, the kind I've been having all my life.
And it worked.
And it worked, yeah. I mean, then, you know, the next day, then I had to move on to the stage in the practice. And,
mm-hmm.
and I kept on confronting these moments of great personal boundaries where I would just feel like, I can't do this. I just can't do it.
Mm.
And then I would push through those moments and keep going.
Oh, good for you. You did good. Just watching the speech.
You.
I watched it last night
you.
Online.
Yeah. I just want to say that because I feel like, you know, most people don't talk about these things, right? You know, they get up and pretend that it's all coming with great ease. And I think that's sort of a disservice to the rest of us for whom it doesn't come easily.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about introverts and people who deal with that and how to deal with it with an author of a new book, Susan Cain. The book is titled Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Let's go to some phone calls here in Ben from Kansas City, Kansas. Ben, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Nice to have you, Ben.
As an introvert, I'm sure you can understand that I can feel my heart racing right now being online. I just wanted to make a comment that introversion is partly misunderstood in the populace as far as what it really means to be an introvert. I think a lot of people just assume, well, if you're introverted, that means you're quiet,
mm-hmm.
you're shy, you don't like interacting with people. But truly, introversion versus extroversion, when it comes down to it, is just about how you process information, how introspective you are. So we had somebody visit our company and kind of score us all on the Myers-Briggs scale, and
mm-hmm.
I was surprised at people that I perceived to be introverted were extroverted by that scale, and people that I would have thought were more extroverted came out as introverted, because really, it's not how much you talk or how you socially interact necessarily, although it does often fall in those boundaries of introversion and extroversion. It's more about whether or not you process your information by speaking with others
mm-hmm.
or looking within.
That's interesting. Susan?
Yeah, well, you know, this was actually, thank you, Ben, so much for your call. This was one of the trickiest things I found when I was doing my book research, because, you know, it turns out there are almost as many definitions of introversion and extroversion as there are personality psychologists. So there's the Myers-Briggs one that's very popular, and there are a whole number of others. And so you know, what I tried to do is I tried to figure out sort of what are the commonalities among all these different taxonomies of personality psychology. And what it came down to me from what I could see was that it has to do with processing information, and it also has to do, as I was saying sort of more broadly, it has to do with how you respond to stimulation of all kinds. Hmm. So I'll just give you one example. Noise stimulation. The psychologist Russell Gein did this fascinating experiment where he gave introverts and extroverts math problems to solve with varying levels of background noise. And he found that the introverts did better when the background noise was lower.
Oh,
and the extroverts did better when it was higher.
That's interesting.
And that to me, I just felt like that was profound because, like, if you think about how we design, let's say, a workplace, it's usually a sort of one-size-fits-all environment. But what an experiment like that suggests is that we really need environments that can be more tailored to each person's individual needs.
Yeah.
And then they'll all be performing at their best.
Ben, thank you for the call.
Thank you.
We'll talk in our second half about how you can tell if you're an introvert or not. Let's go to Richard from Kansas City, Missouri. Richard, good morning.
Hey, thanks for the show. I consider myself an introvert. I can be on stage both figuratively and literally for a certain amount of time, and then I have to step off. I can't stay there all the time. And I think your author really hit the nail on the head with talking about, you know, people are viewed as either shy or antisocial, which I'm really neither. I just can't be on stage. I can't be on stage all the time. In fact, the company that I worked for years and years, I was considered one of the best presenters in the company. Have given literally hundreds of presentations to both small and large groups. But as far as like working in an office setting with lots of cubicles, that bothers me. I have to go off in a corner someplace as quiet a spot as I can to work. And after I've been on stage with either with a group of people or out in a social setting, then I'm ready to kind of retreat. But I'm not shy, and I don't walk down the street with dark glasses and my collar pulled up. And I think that's what a lot of people think introverts are, is people that can't socially interact. It's just that we choose our level of social interaction, and we kind of limit it.
Well, yeah, and you need to recharge. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, Susan, to hear Richard talk, it just strikes me there surely are some companies out there that recognize this and can certainly benefit if they do recognize the distinctions here and can help folks who are more introverted work in ways and work in situations and places physically where they can get the best out of themselves.
Yep, that's right. And in fact, there was one company that I visited when I was doing my book research, a company called Backbone Entertainment. They design video games. They have a lot of introverted, sort of creative introvert designers. And at one point, they had been thinking of moving over to a real open plan office with no walls. And I think they actually did move over to that. And they found that their designers were very unhappy. And so they switched back to cubicles. I know Richard was saying you don't like cubicles, but I guess it's all relative. And what they found was that the designers were happier with the cubicles than with the open plan because they had nooks and crannies that they could go to, you know, their own private spaces. So there are companies who think carefully about it. And I also know Steelcase, one of the leading office design companies, is now actively exploring ways that they can create offices that have individual private spaces as well as the big group spaces that we've been moving to in the past years.
Yeah. Richard, I'm glad you called. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go to J.R. from Kansas City, Missouri. J.R., you're on with Susan Kane. Good morning.
Hi. I'm a recovering introvert. When I was young, as a teenager, and getting ready to graduate high school and getting ready to go away to college, I said, I'm going away. Everybody doesn't know me, so I've got this reputation of being an introvert. I'll be an extrovert when I get there. And I tried, and I did successfully convert my approach to life to being an extrovert somewhat. I still have the tendencies for introspection and all the other introvert sort of things, but the thing that, you know, was the most difficult for me, and I imagine it would be for most people, was that I didn't learn the social cues growing up, up to my teen years, that an extrovert picks up just by osmosis.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to all kinds of disasters in its own way. But after I learned things, you know, it was okay. But that is one thing that if you do want to change and you believe you can change, I think you can.
Well, that raises a question in my mind, Susan. Can people be both introverted and extroverted? And I think the answer to that question is yes, because you talk about some folks who are labeled as ambiverts. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, for people who really are smack in the middle of the introvert-extrovert spectrum, psychologists call those people ambiverts. But what I should say, too, is that even for people who really feel like, no, you know, I'm really pretty far along the introvert spectrum or pretty far along the extrovert spectrum, not an ambivert, I'm an introvert, I'm an extrovert. Even for those people, there's no such thing as a total introvert or a total extrovert. We all have pieces of the other side in us. And so, you know, introverts sometimes feel like the life of the party type of extrovert and vice versa. And then I also think what our caller is talking about is, you know, you can develop, as an introvert, you might start out with a certain level of discomfort in social situations. I mean, some introverts feel that, not all of them. But there are ways to develop social skills that lessen those feelings of discomfort. I do find that for those kinds of introverts, even so, they still end up needing the time to recharge after they've kind of been out there in the social world.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the people who I profiled in my book, one of my favorite people who I met is a guy named Brian Little, really lovely guy. He's a world-class lecturer and performer. Every time he gives a lecture, he gets a standing ovation. But he's a super introvert, and he says that after every, you know, amazing performance, he has to race for the nearest restroom so that he can recharge in private instead of being mobbed by all the people who want to come and talk to him.
I was going to ask you about him. I thought he was fascinating, too. Just amazing. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he's a lovely guy. And he's also a personality psychologist who has developed this whole field of personality psychology that is all about the need to sometimes act out of character for the sake of work that you love or people that you love, but to always come back to your core self to keep yourself sane and healthy and happy.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here with Susan Cain, author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And we'll take our own little quiz here that the publisher provided that determines whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. And I'll tell you where I came down on this thing. And later on this hour, the joy of barbershop quartets. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's discussion with Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, you'll find that in all of our broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, Missouri-born artist Thomas Hart Benton. Was history fair to him? Plus, Brian McTavish returns with his weekend to-do list. This hour, we're talking with an author, Susan Cain, author of Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, update@kcur.org. You know, Susan, I was wondering, how much does heredity play into whether one person is an introvert and one person is an extrovert? What's heredity have to do with it?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, it turns out for a lot of people, it has a lot to do with it. You know, as with anything, it can be a mixed bag, but introversion and extroversion are considered among the most heritable of personality traits. And in particular, there is one temperament that some babies are born with that predisposes them to be either shy or introverted or both. And that is a temperament that makes babies just sort of more careful and more sensitive and noticing new things more than another baby would. And it's really fascinating. You know, you can see this temperament in action when babies are days old. If you give them sugar water to suck on. Babies who have the more careful, more sensitive temperament will suck more vigorously on the sugar water than other babies will, and that's because they're more sensitive to new stimuli that's coming their way. And you can trace this all the way through their lives. So those same babies at the age of two, if you introduce them to a playgroup of kids they've never seen before, they're going to check out this new situation for longer, and you know, be sort of classic slower to warm up children.
Yeah.
And as they grow, you see these same tendencies. I mean, what's interesting about it is we tend to think of all this stuff as just being, how do you react socially? You know, how does this kid react when they go to a birthday party?
Mm-hmm.
But it's really deeper than that. It has to do with how you process the world cognitively too. So that kids who have this kind of temperament, they process intellectual puzzles more carefully as well. Like if you give them the type of puzzle where you have two pictures that look very similar and you have to discern the subtle differences between the two,
right.
These kids will look at the pictures more intensely and get the right answer more often.
Hmm.
And this seems to translate into intellectual advantages also. I mean, they get better grades in school, they win more scholarships. And what's interesting about that is that introverts are not any smarter than extroverts. You know, in terms of IQ, there's no difference. But this same tendency to be more careful and to pay very close and subtle attention to the environment, that's kind of a tendency that sometimes gets introverts criticized, but it has payoffs that we don't always recognize.
Let's go to Joyce from Kansas City, Missouri. Joyce, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I have noticed among my friends that we have a tendency to admire the traits in someone else that we don't possess. And so a lot of us have married our total opposites. And then we have to figure out how we're going to get along with that.
Yes, yes.
Well said, Joyce. Yeah. Susan, did you marry an opposite yourself, Susan?
Yes, and in fact, I have a whole chapter which is in the book about introvert-extrovert couples, and I am an introvert married to an extrovert. And I think you're so right. You know, I think introverts and extroverts are kind of yin and yang, who are drawn to each other. But I interviewed many of these couples, and I found that there were certain conflicts that came up again and again and again for these couples, with probably the biggest one being, how much are we going to socialize as a couple? You know, what do you do if one person, their perfect idea of a Friday night is staying home and snuggling on the sofa,
yeah,
and the other one wants to go out to a party? How do you manage that?
Right, right.
And what I find helps is that, you know, if you understand that you're each coming at this from a very different temperamental place, and negotiate some kind of protocol in advance that you both can live with. Like, maybe you say, every Friday night we'll stay home, and every Saturday night we'll go out. And then you don't have to have the same argument week after week after week. You've done it all in advance.
Well, in the press packet for your book from Crown, there is a very large headline, Are You an Introvert? And there are 12 questions here, all very short. I thought I'd run through these real quick and tell you how I scored, okay?
okay.
Number one, I prefer one-on-one conversations to group activities. I think I said yes on that one. Number two, I often prefer to express myself in writing. I didn't check that one. So if you're playing along at home, just keep track of how many you're checking here. Number three, I enjoy solitude. I said yes. Number four, I seem to care about wealth, fame, and status less than my peers. I didn't check that one. Number five, people tell me that I'm a good listener. Well, I've got to be in this profession. At least I hope so.
Yeah, you sure do.
I checked that one. Yeah, so I'm 3 for 5 so far. Number six, I'm not a big risk taker. I said, yeah, that's probably true. Number seven, I enjoy work that allows me to dive in with few interruptions. Absolutely. I checked that. Sometimes the kids, when I'm working on the show at night and the kids want to talk, Okay, number eight, I like to celebrate birthdays on a small scale with only one or two close friends or family members. I checked that one, too. Number nine, people describe me as soft-spoken or mellow. I didn't check that one. Number 10, I prefer not to show or discuss my work with others until it's finished. I think that's probably true. And I tend to think before I speak, maybe many times. I often let calls go through to voicemail. That's the final question, and that's not true for me. So for that one, I scored 8 of 12. I checked a box. And Susan, what does that mean for a guy like me? Is there any hope, or am I lost forever here?
Well, I think really the point of what I'm saying in the book is that
no one's lost forever. You know, that it doesn't matter whether you check 1 or 12 or anything in between. You know, that we really need all kinds and that there's value to all kinds. What I'm saying is that we need balance between the two. So it sounds like you're more on the introverted side of the spectrum, but not completely.
Yeah, I think I'm one of those ambiverts. I think I sort of go back and forth, I think, between the two. So that's where I am probably on this list.
Yeah, and I often think that people who are ambiverts really have the best of both worlds, because it's kind of like you have yin and yang all in one person. So I think that can work out really well.
Well, for me, life is like a bowl of chocolate ice cream every minute of every day. That's for sure. So I guess that works out for me. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, update@kcur.org. You know, in Quiet, your book, you point out differences between Western culture, where the individual is paramount, and Eastern culture, where the success of the group often has a higher value. So all cultures don't have an extrovert ideal, right?
Right, that's right. This was one of the most interesting parts of my research, I thought. You know, if you look at traditional Far Eastern societies, it is, as you say, more focused around the success of the group. And while that sounds like that's very group-oriented and it cultivates a more gregarious type of person, it's actually the opposite, because if you care about group harmony, then what you want is people who are a little quieter, a little less assuming, so that the group harmony is not threatened. And so what you find in these cultures is that silence is valued and words themselves are seen as potentially dangerous weapons. Because, you know, if you talk too much, you can hurt someone else's feelings, you can get yourself into trouble. So people who don't speak as much are often seen as being very wise and judicious and reserved in a very cultivated way. One of my favorite, I think this is a Japanese expression that expresses this idea, is the wind howls, but the mountain remains still. And I think that says it all.
Mm-hmm. You know, of all the famous people in history, Susan, who were introverts, I was really surprised to read that Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, who accomplished so much as First Lady, and you always think of her in large crowds of people, was actually an introvert. Who surprised you the most?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, there's one surprising one who, you know, I actually didn't write about him in my book, but interesting figure, and this is Barack Obama, who I would say is probably an introvert. You know, not a shy one. I don't think he worries excessively about what people think of him, which is what a shy person does. But he really is a person who is comfortable in his solitude. And he even talks about it. If you look at the first couple pages of his memoir, Dreams from My Father, he says, "I feel safest when I'm in solitude." And, you know, in fact, we've seen in his years in office, one of the things he's been criticized for most is not being out and about in the Washington social circuit. So he's an interesting figure. And, but, you know, I looked at a lot of transformative leaders in the books. There was Eleanor Roosevelt, who you mentioned, Gandhi, Rosa Parks. And all these people were transformative leaders who were described as being quiet and shy. And what was interesting to me about that is that it was, in a way, those descriptions that were sort of at the heart of their power, because people could sense that when leaders like this took the spotlight, that they were there not because they liked to be looked at. You know, they didn't get any joy from controlling people or from being admired. They were there because they had no choice, you know, because they really cared about what they were saying. And people can sense that.
Yeah, great point.
Yeah.
Well, Susan, thanks so much for your time today. It was great to have you, and what a great topic. And I know your book has been such a rousing success, so thanks so much for taking some time.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure to be here with you. Really enjoyed it.
All the best.
Okay.
That's author Susan Cain, her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking.